This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his book, Why Americans Hate Politics, E.J. Dionne tried to make sense of the growing cynicism, apathy, and even anger expressed by so many voters. We invited him to look at the results of yesterday's Iowa caucuses. Dionne is a syndicated political columnist at The Washington Post. He has a new book called They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Bob Dole emerged the winner by a narrow margin in Iowa. Patrick Buchanan came in a close second, followed by Lamar Alexander, Steve Forbes, and Phil Graham. I asked E.J. Dionne what he thinks the lead story is here.
Well, I think the lead is probably the fact that fewer than 100,000 people voted, and that this campaign has been abysmal. It is the most negative campaign I have seen in a primary, I think, ever, you know, in my lifetime. The second lead is that the Republican Revolution that we talked about so much last year was really not much to be seen in Iowa, that Bob Dole, the incumbent leader in the Senate, won but barely hung on. Phil Graham, who is the purest of the revolutionaries, came in fifth. And that Pat Buchanan, who has been sounding, when he talks like economics, like Ralph Nader in attacking corporations and Wall Street, came in second, a lot stronger than people thought. So I think it's a sign of some kind of turn in our politics, what happened out in Iowa.
What turn?
Well, I think it's a turn, first of all, away from simply arguing about the balanced budget. When people wake up in the morning, they don't talk about how do you balance the budget on CBO numbers and that sort of thing that we've been talking about so much for the last year in Washington. I think that the central issue that Americans are concerned about has to do with living standards and a link between, if you will, moral issues and economics. And I think that the Republicans for a long time had been trying to define moral issues very narrowly in terms of almost a Christian coalition agenda about family values. But liberals really weren't talking about morality very much, and so they were leaving it to the Christian right. I think now people understand that the economics and family values, for example, go together. And if somebody is asking themselves the question, am I working hard enough to support my kids, or am I working so hard that I don't have time to spend with my kids and teach them what I think they should learn? Well, that's about economics and it's about morals. And I think Pat Buchanan does this message and this idea very differently from the way I would do it. And his ideas are very different from mine, but I think he has found a way to talk to that nexus in a way that almost no other candidate has.
You say that the low turnout is very significant. Do you think that the low turnout reflects the theme of your previous book, Why Americans Hate Politics?
I think that the low turnout is in part a reflection of just how nasty the campaign was. I mean, negative campaigning, if it's about real issues, can at least be informative. This is trivial negative campaigning. The kind of ads Forbes ran, for example, against Dole, whether he voted to increase Senate pensions or not, which in fact he didn't. And I think voters just didn't like that. And here you had a Republican Party whose members were poised for a real debate in 96. They thought they were on the upswing. And suddenly they discover these guys hammering at each other in a way that a lot of voters out there found disgusting. I think the second thing is that you just don't have enthusiasm in the Republican Party today the way you had in 1994. I think in 1994, you had a Republican Party that really disliked President Clinton, that really disliked the Democratic Congress, and they were motivated to get out to vote, and that's one of the reasons they won that election. You don't see that out there now, and I think that's one of the things that happened out in Iowa.
Now, why do you think Dole had such a lackluster performance in the caucuses?
Well, it's funny because in a lot of ways you look at all these Republicans and you say Bob Dole is probably the most plausible president of the lot. I don't think very many people would wake up at night worrying if Bob Dole were president. That's his greatest asset. But what you also have a sense of is that Bob Dole doesn't make people feel great. He doesn't make them excited. It's sort of safety, but not much more than that. And that gave him a lot of trouble in motivating voters. I think the other problem Bob Dole has had is that he started out this campaign saying that the way I got to win this is not let Phil Graham get to my right, and I've got to be loyal to the revolution in Washington. And suddenly the revolution in Washington just completely lost all its steam. And so the kind of campaign Dole anticipated having to run turned out not to be the campaign most relevant to voters when the caucuses came around.
What do you think Lamar Alexander did well? You describe him in a column today as Dole Light.
Right. He's Dole light in the sense that, like Dole, he has quite a lot of government experience, indeed probably more than he likes to own up to sometimes. But he has not been so engaged in Washington that he can be easily tarred for that. In fact, he's trying to run as an outsider with the flannel shirt. I think the other thing is almost classic in political campaigns, where you have lots of other candidates dumping mud on each other, and the candidate who manages to stay out of the fight sneaks up the middle. And it's very interesting that Buchanan was, to a significant degree, disengaged from a lot of the negative stuff, and so was Alexander. So I think when people went to the caucuses, a lot of people who might like Bob Dole and respect Bob Dole said, I don't think he can win. Alexander seems fresher. And I think it's significant that the exit polls showed that one of the most important reasons people voted for Alexander was simply that he was a candidate who could defeat Clinton, which still, for a lot of Republicans, is the highest priority.
E.J. Dionne is my guest, political columnist for The Washington Post and author of the new book, They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Pat Buchanan did very well, came in second yesterday in Iowa. What do you think he is doing that's winning votes right now?
Well, there are a couple of things. I think the first thing is we still have not had a mass participation primary where lots of people vote. He won in Louisiana, where the turnout was anemic, in a state with 4,000 precincts. There are only 42 polling places. In Iowa, as we said, the turnout was very low yesterday, so that somebody with a very committed following can do very well in low turnout caucuses. Pat Robertson did very well in Iowa in 1988. And I think that over time, Pat Buchanan has convinced an awful lot of the religious conservatives that, in fact, he can make a showing. That Bob Dole was hoping that if the contest came down to him and to Steve Forbes, the religious right would come to him not out of enthusiasm, but feeling that he was closer to them than Forbes. As Forbes started fading and as Buchanan started winning these victories, I think a lot of the Christian conservatives said, hey, we can make a really strong statement if we give Pat Buchanan a big vote out of here. And I think that's what they did.
What do you make of the crescendo and diminuendo of Steve Forbes?
Oh, that was nicely put. I don't think he's over yet. As Jesse Jackson once said, God isn't finished with him yet. I think that on the one hand, you had a problem for Steve Forbes in Iowa because caucuses still require a lot of organization. You can't buy organization. A lot of those votes are people talking to each other. It's really old-fashioned town meeting democracy. And people who are committed to a particular candidate sell that candidate to their friends and neighbors. He didn't have that. Secondly, I think there was a real reaction against how negative his campaign was, that he was really running what seemed like a very clever double campaign, you know, hope, optimism, a forward-looking talk on the stump with all these negative ads on television. I think that hurt him. And I think the third thing is that every time you've tested the flat tax in a political campaign, the more voters know about it, the less they like it. In New York, Bill Clinton killed Jerry Brown in the 92 primaries by running against the flat tax, because it's very hard to have a flat tax that doesn't cut taxes for the rich and raise taxes on the heart of the middle class, not even on the poor, but on the heart of the middle class and the upper middle class. And it either does that or balloons the deficit. And I think that message started to get through.
What do you think is the real importance of the Iowa caucuses? Everybody's focusing on it and analyzing it today, but how much does it really tell us?
Well, I think it's important for Phil Graham, because I think it's going to be very hard after losing Louisiana and Iowa for him to make a plausible case that he's got a chance to win, which is something that primary voters in this strange process of ours start to think about. As I say, I think the low turnout is something that Republicans ought to spend a lot of time thinking about. I think Bob Dole is happy to have squeezed by, especially since 2 or 3 weeks ago people were saying, gee, he might lose this to Steve Forbes. But I think the next week is going to be a very hard week for Bob Dole. Poor Bob Dole always has very hard weeks once he gets up to New Hampshire. And I think that what's going to happen is that a lot of New Hampshire Republicans who don't particularly like Buchanan and want to win the election are going to start weighing Alexander in more seriously than they did. Alexander becomes this time around what Gary Hart was against Walter Mondale. He seems to be the candidate with the best chance of winning as the alternative to Dole. And I think that's got to worry Dole, because I think it's hard to get a handle on Alexander and attack him, because there's nothing much about him that's offensive to Republicans.
Political columnist for The Washington Post, E.J. Dion, is my guest. He's the author of Why Americans Hate Politics and a new book called They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Washington Post political columnist E.J. Dion. In your new book, you write about a large group of voters that you call the anxious middle. I want you to describe who they are and why you've named them thus.
Well, I should say, in fairness to the good people who have taught me a lot, the anxious middle is in part a marriage of two formulations. One is Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who talks a lot about the anxious class, a group of people out in the country who are basically middle class in their attitudes and in their standard of living, who are deeply worried about watching their prospects sink in this new economy of ours, variously described as global or high technology. The middle part comes from a formulation by my colleague Joe Klein over at Newsweek, who talks about the radical middle. And I think that those two formulations together really tell you a lot about what's going on at the heart of American politics, that you have a whole group of people who are worried about their economic state, who are worried about the country's moral state, not in a narrow sort of sense about trying to impose moral values on people, but just sort of what do we stand for? What are the rewards for hard work? How are my kids going to make it through both a hard economic situation and a time when the values parents want to pass along to their kids seem threatened? These voters are ready to swing all over the lot because they are troubled and unhappy. And in 1992, they helped elect Bill Clinton and helped give Ross Perot a big vote. And in 1994, they were very disappointed by what the Democrats did. I think what's important to see about the movement in American politics in the last 3 years is that it's not about a move to the right. And that's one of the core arguments of my book, is that it's a real mistake to view this in those kind of ideological terms. The Democrats ran in 1992 with their own contract with America. They were basically promising health care reform, meaning trying to find ways to make sure everybody has health insurance. Welfare reform, which is to find a way to be generous to the poor, but also to help poor people move into work. Political reform to reduce the impact of special interest money on politics. And an effort to use education and job training to ease people's transition to the new economy. If you look at what happened in the 1993-94 Congress, Democrats just didn't deliver any of those things. Healthcare reform died, welfare reform died, political reform died, and all those nice job training and education initiatives didn't get funded very much. And so I think when you looked at what the voters did in 94, this was the anxious middle saying, you didn't do what you promised, we're going to vote Republican. But they weren't looking for a right-wing revolution, they were looking for government that worked, and they still haven't found it.
Now, a concern of yours is that this group that you refer to as the anxious middle, which has the potential of being radicalized, also has the potential to vote for leaders with an authoritarian tinge. Why do you think that has the potential of happening?
When people are frustrated, they can do all sorts of things. I mean, if you go back to the fight over Prop 187 in California, I think, which was about immigration and restricting government aid to illegal immigrants, I think a lot of people who voted for Prop 187, partly they were just concerned that the federal government wasn't controlling the borders. Partly it was an expression of frustration that the California economy had gone through such a terrible period, and it was their way of sending a message. Pat Buchanan is very smart in the way he uses immigration to tap into the anger out there. He uses affirmative action to tap into his opposition to affirmative action to tap into that anger. And that I think if voters are continually frustrated at government's ability to solve problems, they will reach for whatever lever is at hand to express their anger. That's why Ross Perot did so well. He was a choice completely out of the mainstream, and voters were willing to take a chance on this person whom they really didn't know very well. And even after he showed himself to be, charitably, sort of less than the sort of calmest, steadiest person in the world at the end of that campaign, a lot of people were still willing to say, I just want to tell these guys I am really angry. That feeling is still out there, and it can go in a lot of directions.
So you think that when voters look for a strong political leader who can fix things, that instinct can sometimes lead to voting for somebody with an authoritarian strain?
It can be. Now, I think it's important that in the United States, our history, partly I think because of the strength of our progressive tradition, our history has been that we always turn away from that. You know, that when the Soviet Union had Stalin, and when Germany had Hitler, and when Spain had Franco, we had Franklin Roosevelt. We were the country in this period of Great Depression, huge economic distress, we were the country that kept its head, and that we saved democracy, partly because we saved it at home first. And I think that in the end, the radical democratic streak in Americans is usually triumphs over any sort of authoritarian streak. And I guess one of the reasons I express a lot of frustration in my book with liberals and Democrats is because I think it's their job to find ways of answering this frustration by using what power government does have to ease this very difficult transition period. And I think one of the mistakes liberals have made over the years is that they've forgotten what liberalism in America, and I don't use progressive to avoid the word liberal, I think liberal is a good word, but what they've done is they've forgotten that you don't use government for the sake of government. You don't use government to expand government. We've used government to enhance the possibilities of individuals to achieve greater self-reliance. Essentially, government in the United States has always helped people to reach a point where they could do without help. And that's what the message of progressivism ought to be. You know, in programmatic terms, it's things like the GI Bill, which helped millions of people go to college. It's student loans, which actually were passed under a Republican president that helped me and lots of other people go to college. Government can step in and make people's lives better by making them, in a sense, freer. I think we've completely forgotten that role for government in all of these polemics against big government.
Washington Post political columnist E.J. Dionne is my guest. Your new book is called They Only Look Dead: Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Before I ask you why you think progressives will dominate the next political era, who do you mean when you use the word progressives?
Well, one of the things I don't mean is to use progressive as a way of avoiding the word liberal. Sometimes I think progressive is what liberals call themselves after they look at the polls. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the word liberal or with a liberal tradition. But I use the word progressive specifically to define what I think is actually the strongest strain in our political life over the last 100 years. It's a progressivism that goes back to Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and included Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and even involved an awful lot of other more moderate Republican figures. If you look at Dwight Eisenhower, he used government in a way Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt would be proud of, with the student loan program and the interstate highway system, which led to an awful lot of public investment in the economy. I think what's happened is that the new Republican majority in Congress is not simply interested in cutting back government here or there. I think they are really seriously interested in rolling back the whole progressive tradition and going back to a kind of 19th century approach that would have minimal government involvement, minimal government protections for people. Now, they obviously have great trouble getting there. And why did they run into trouble in the last Congress? They ran into trouble in the last Congress because Americans in their hearts are still, I think, progressive. Progressive in the sense that they haven't given up on government's capacities. They haven't given up on the idea that it isn't a bad thing for government to provide health insurance for our parents and grandparents and poor kids and the like. And so when these issues were actually joined in a practical way, as against a rhetorical way, the country said, no, that's not what we're really for. And that's why I think this progressive strain is strong and will come back on the upswing because we've started joining the argument in a real way, in a way we hadn't. And that, I think, is what's changed since Why Americans Hate Politics, is that I think the argument now has the potential of becoming much more real than it was when I wrote that earlier book.
Well, do you see anybody in politics now who embodies the argument that you're making?
No, I see pieces of it. Clinton does it sometimes. President Clinton does it sometimes. Senator Bill Bradley does it sometimes. Those are probably the two people I think of most. But I think a lot of the sort of younger Democrats and some of the progressive Republicans who are trying to figure out where do they really stand vis-a-vis this Gingrich revolution, that there are a lot of people out there who are saying we want to turn away from the debate we've had for the last year because we know that voters are turned off by it. And one of the things I try to talk about a lot in the book is the importance of seeing progressivism as a bipartisan tradition. Now, I don't expect progressivism to become dominant in the Republican Party. What I do expect is a lot of Republicans who still carry those ideas and feelings to have to make a choice now that they didn't feel they had to make until now. And when you look at a vote on the environmental issues, 50 Republicans have steadily defected to the Democratic side, if you will, because they said, no, environmentalism is in the tradition of our own party. That's Teddy Roosevelt's tradition. We don't want to give up on that. And so I think a lot of people are being sort of called, their consciences are being challenged in this period. And I think that's going to be good for us in the long run.
E.J. Dionne is a political columnist for The Washington Post. His new book is called They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Washington Post political columnist E.J. Dionne. He's the author of the book, Why Americans Hate Politics. In his new book, They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era, he argues that Democrats can either revitalize their party for the next century or watch as their party collapses into incoherence and irrelevance. You write in your book that you think liberals made a mistake by allowing themselves to be seen as defending the status quo.
Right. Well, I think that liberals are supposed to be the party of reform. That is, when people voted for liberal candidates, they were always voting for reform. And they were also always voting, I think, or mostly voting for an experimental approach to government. One of FDR's most famous lines was a call for bold, persistent experimentation and to try something, and if it didn't work, to try something else. I think liberals painted themselves, and also their conservatives were very effective in painting them as defenders of whatever old program they had established in the past. And I think one of the mistakes the Clinton administration made was in not trying to link up Vice President Gore's reinventing government project to its broader purposes. Because what Gore was really doing there is saying, look, Democrats, liberals, progressives, people who favor active government also understand that you can't necessarily do everything the same way all the time over a 50-year period, that there are some programs that need to be junked and other programs that need to be reshaped. I mean, the most, in terms of sort of progressive orthodoxy, the most heretical notion I have in the book is that I don't think that liberals ought to be opposed to experiments with school vouchers in the poorest neighborhoods of our country. If the public schools in very poor neighborhoods are really awful and parents want to look for alternatives, I don't think liberals should be standing in the way of that. Vouchers are not an alternative to public education. They shouldn't be used to destroy public education. But why not do some experiments? I think a kind of experimental approach to liberalism is what makes people turn to liberals in times of crisis.
A few years ago, you wrote a book called Why Americans Hate Politics, a title that had, I think, a lot of resonance.
It was my wife's brilliant idea, and I always want to credit her for it.
Well, good. And in that book, you wrote that politics right now is framing the political debate with a series of false choices. Do you think that we still are confronted with these false choices?
I think liberals and progressives have been much too wary in trying to join the moral debate and in saying that the choice before us is not between the Christian Coalition and Pat Robertson on the one side or a complete indifference to the coarsening of our culture on the other side. Most people don't want either of those choices. Most Americans are tolerant, reasonably tolerant, open-minded. They're also we are also the most religious country in the world. We care a lot about God and family and our children, and that we ought to be able to find a way of talking about these issues that doesn't seem to cast out a huge chunk of our country. And I think we also have to figure out how to talk about these issues in a way that says that morality is not just about sort of the bedroom issues that we are always seem to be obsessed with. It's also about what kind of rewards are people going to get for living a decent life. If people work hard and they worry about their neighbors and their communities and they try to raise their kids, for them, for those people, the central moral issue is this approach to life, which I believe to be the moral approach, is this going to get rewarded in our society, or are we going to get run over? I think that's what a lot of those folks feel, and that's how we need to broaden the moral debate. So in that sense, I still think we need to wage a war on a certain kind of false choice that's out there.
In your book, Why Americans Hate Politics, you offered One reason is being the trivialization of American politics and, you know, Americans' frustration with that trivialization. Do you think we still face that?
Well, we sure did in the Iowa caucuses and in the, and we do in the advertising in the New Hampshire primary. I think part of the problem is that Republicans for a long time ran against government without trying to cut government back, which is why we got the deficit. And while I disagree with a lot of the choices this Republican Congress made, at least they had the guts finally to say, we got to stop doing that. We've got to start making some real choices if we're going to talk about this small government stuff. I think the problem is a lot of Americans don't necessarily like the choices they made. On the other side, Democrats often tried to pretend, oh, we're really just as anti-government as the Republicans are. We're just sort of nicer about it. And I think Democrats really fall down on their job when they fail to sort of stand up and say, no, we don't think government can do everything, but we do think government has a legitimate role in American life. When you have both parties kind of engaging in this politics of evasion, as somebody once called it, people get cynical. When people get cynical, the advertising gets more cynical to appeal to a cynical electorate, and we end up having ads that drive down turnout. I think when we talked once before, I said that I'm amazed by political advertising because if the advertising we had for food products were like the advertising we had for candidates, we'd all lose a lot of weight because we wouldn't eat anything. If one apple manufacturer said about the other what Steve Forbes says about Bob Dole.
Are there things that you think you can bring to the American political debate as a columnist that you couldn't as a reporter?
That's a wonderful question, and sometimes I don't even like to face the question, I think. I think, you know, the good thing about being a columnist is that you can have sort of complete truth in labeling. You know, the people who read you regularly, and even the people who read you occasionally, know where you're coming from, so they can put what you're saying in a context, and, you know, if they think they disagree with your whole worldview, they'll put what you say in one context, and if they agree with you, they'll put it in another. And I think there's a great advantage to that in being able to just make arguments in that way. On the other side, there's still part of me that tugs me back to old-fashioned reporting. I think that there is a problem in our culture and in the journalistic culture, or the media culture, really, right now, of clashing opinions without facts. That we treat opinions as having the same value as facts. We allow people to toss out almost anything and, well, say that's just another point of view. Well, there are some things that are true and there are some things that are not true. And one of the good things about good old-fashioned journalism, and I hope we don't lose it in this culture of clashing opinions, is that we better worry about whether these opinions are based on things that are true or whether they simply come out of thin air or based on falsehoods. And I think there's a danger here.
Well, E.J. Dionne, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it is a great pleasure.
E.J. Dionne is a political columnist for The Washington Post. His new book is called They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. This is Fresh Air.